te vasudevaya. Om. So we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 15, entitled The Killing of Dhenuka, the Ass Demon, Text 13. Please repeat after me. Chakora krauncha chakrava bharadvajamscha barhina anurautisma satvanam bhitavad vyagra simhayo. Translation and purport by disciples of His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. Sometimes he would cry out in imitation of birds, such as the chakoras, craunchas, chakravas, bharadvajas, and peacocks. And sometimes he would run away with the smaller animals in mock fear of lions and tigers. Purport. The word bhitavat, as if afraid, indicates that Lord Krishna played just like an ordinary boy and ran with the smaller forest creatures in mock fear of the lions and tigers. Actually, in Vrindavan, the abode of the Lord, the lions and tigers are not violent, and thus there is no reason to fear them. So here we see a very beautiful description of how the Lord is so merciful to all living entities. Krishna does not discriminate, you know, among, let alone living entities, but even among the animals, not just human beings, but even the smaller animals. And, you know, there's such a loving reciprocation. Actually, it is a fact that even in today's world, you know, if you, even the wild animals, we call them wild animals, but actually if they are not harmed, generally they don't, if you do not provoke them, they don't harm. So basically, today, much of the, you know, the fear of wild animals is actually provoked by human beings. You know, the environment that we have taken away from them, how they, and they can only react instinctively. They cannot think or rationalize. So, and here of course, in the times of Lord Krishna, and then later on when he comes as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the love and reciprocation, which is not apparent to us today, I don't think we would be expecting to treat tigers and lions the same way. But at least the least we can do is to not harm them, or at least be sensitive to their needs, so that they don't, they can live in the way they are meant to live. And in almost all cases, you know, it is they would also let human beings live the way we are supposed to live. So it is like live and let live. But this never, because of the nature of the material world, this sense of discrimination prevails. In ultimately, only the pure devotees, they have the Pandita Samadarshina view of all living entities, you know, Krishna and every living entity. And only then they are able to actually see Krishna is the common link in all the in all the living entities. But till that time, we tend to discriminate, and we would always see them as superior and inferior. And we see the result that everywhere we around us, the whole world is based on discrimination. Whether you take it on a country level or on individual level. On country levels also, you there's always the rich nations and the poor nations, and there will always be fighting amongst them for all the laws of the world have been created by the rich nations, at least in this last 100 years, the way the world should be governed, whether it's the United Nations or the World Bank or International Monetary Fund or any of the institutions, is basically a creation of the world, the rich nations, to protect their strength. So naturally, the poorer nations are revolting against that. Within the rich nations also, you have different classes. Those who have been there for many generations, they feel threatened by the immigrants. And then you have the visa issues. Every country has, it's like fearful, who will get in, who will come in uninvited. And there's strict laws to put them in jail. Recently, I read that somebody created some visa minor infringement or fraud, and that person has been put in jail and is facing, in the Middle East, a death sentence. So this comes about because there is always us and them. Even among the poorer nations, then there will be caste issues. There will be discrimination among either on basis of community or caste or basis of economic strength, those who, the haves and the have-nots. Within the poorer nations also, those who have, either they have got from their own ancestors or they have, by Krishna's arrangement, they have been able to make a lot of money, they would like to protect it. So their whole view would be to preserve. And then those who don't have it, they feel it is unfair and they would like to create a situation where there is equality. Sometimes it is by violence, sometimes it is by manipulation, but inevitably there will be pressure. Then there could be discrimination. There is discrimination on age. Now in this selfish world, people are on their own. So the older people feel left out because more and more they are not tended to by anybody. And the young look at it as if it's a burden. They see even the parents. So they have old people's homes. They just park there. And not only park there, it is not only for their own convenience, but there's a growing clamor for saying that because of modern medicine, which prolongs life, they stretches their life longer, that becomes expensive. And in most Western countries, the government pays for it. Therefore, in a difficult economic situation, a lot of the money goes for what they call social security. So younger generation, it's or their own parents and their own uncles and aunts, their own relatives, but still they are complaining that our economic well-being is threatened because a lot of money is going for the older people. This is the kind of mentality, an animalistic mentality that is there. Then there is discrimination between urban and rural. Typically the way the capitalist system works, the economic might gradually comes to only relatively few people, and most of them usually would be in the urban centers. So naturally they will have all the powers of control or levers of control are generally there. It's only when elections come, then suddenly people go to the villages to canvass. So this kind of thing, and this is not only in India, it's everywhere. Basically, so there is because the whole lifestyles are different, and the rural people also feel left out. So in some countries, like in China in the 60s, when Mao Zedong was there, there was a violent overthrow. He had taken power, the communist regime came in 1949, and in 66, there was what they called a cultural revolution. What it actually meant was there was a purging, something like 30 or 40 million people were killed in China alone, their own people, and they were forcibly pushed to go into the rural communes and forced to work. So it was a backlash against intellectuals. So this kind of thing happens because there's always discrimination. And this is the nature of the world. And the discrimination comes because of the lack of understanding that everything belongs to Krishna. It's a simple formula, but as Prabhupada says, it's simple for the simple, but it was complicated for the complicated. So if somebody feels that I don't agree with it, then he will naturally canvass for support among people who will also have the same mentality. So it is quite fitting in a sense that this chapter that we are reading, the killing of Dhenukasur, the ass demon, actually Bhaktivinoda Thakur has given very nice explanation on what each individual demon represents. And Dhenukasur represents gross material intelligence and complete ignorance of spiritual knowledge. So by that definition, we can see that actually the goal of all the leaders of society today, or most civilization today, as we see it, is actually to become Dhenukasur. They will not say it, but if you were to go, that because using the gross material intelligence. And why gross material intelligence? Because the real intelligence, as Prabhupada says, is to understand the facts of life. It is a fool who cannot see the reality. There's a simple way. If somebody says that it is raining outside and you don't look at it and you just walk as if there's a sun and you get drenched, so somebody will say he's a fool. He doesn't even understand a simple truth. But what simpler truth can there be than the fact that every day, every moment practically we can see the anywhere around us examples of how the Lord actually manifests Himself in so many ways. He controls everything, so many things that we cannot control. But because the attitude is that we would like to be the controllers, so it is like each one is competing to see who's the bigger Dhenukasur. I would like to be the gold medal for being the biggest Dhenukasur. So. So it is actually a backlash of how we see the world, which is the way it is going. And then you have quotas, people perhaps well-meaning, but misunderstanding. And then they say that they can forcibly, think that they could have, like in South Africa, they have it in so many countries where they see that some people need to be brought up to a certain level. In India also there is a tendency. They feel that it can be done, but they do not understand that forcibly trying to change the physical external well-being and saying that that this is the way your happiness will be distributed is a complete lack of understanding, because the source of happiness is not the externals. And again, there are very simple examples all around us, and observations will see that those who have a lot, not necessarily happy, and those who don't have are not necessarily unhappy. So it is primarily the inner consciousness, the mind. These are even somebody who actually is given these are the basics and the beginning of spiritual knowledge. If somebody is sincere enough, comes to in contact with devotees, reads bona fide spiritual scripture, would not take much time to understand this, that even if the difficulty in implementation may follow, that needs a process. But understanding this, even a child would understand it. Like Prabhupada would say, that he used to quote many times, and we have heard this example, that when there was a large attendance of many so-called sannyasis and all, and Prabhupada asked them, who's the Supreme Personality of Godhead? And people were giving all kinds of complicated answers. And then he turned to this little girl, Saraswati, the first child born into the ISKCON movement, and she was only 4 years old, and she just said, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Very simple, that we don't need to have a complicated answer. So that Prabhupada said, see, she knows, she understands what the real answer is. So basically, actually the truth is simple to understand, but the process to follow it is not so simple. But naturally, something valuable cannot be just, it cannot be so cheap that anyone can take it, and because that is again our tendency to take it. So therefore, we have to prove our desire, and that desire comes, we can show by determination, by choices that we make, by avoiding various temptations, by sticking to the path, accepting certain austerity of both physical and mental. So these are only tests that are given to us in, to make a choice, and these are given to the human beings. So that is what, so in a very basic form, the religious life, there are two forms of religious life. Either there's a pravritti mark or the nivritti mark. So pravritti mark are those where worshipping demigods or even the supreme personality of Godhead is basically for improving the material condition of life. Nivritti mark would be where there is a sense of renunciation and on the path, the process of self-control and ultimately leading to trying to live a life of putting Krishna in the center of everything that we do. So these are the two choices that everyone has. Either they follow one or the other, whether they understand it or they don't. And even if we mentally understand it, the path of accepting it and following it, the temptations are so many even for a spiritualist, even for a transcendentalist, because that's why Krishna warns Arjuna that don't get carried away by the flowery words of the Vedas. The description of the heavenly planets is so beautiful that we would be tempted to accept that. And that is why we follow authority, a bona fide guru, who tell us as to what we need to avoid, what we need to, even what may be, ultimately these are all sattvic people, people who are followers of Lord Krishna, but nevertheless not accepting the heavenly planets because of the tendency to develop our own desires for material sense gratification, because it then dovetails, thinking that I can just continue, I accept Krishna, and if I continue in the same way, then at least I'll be assured a better form of life, and okay, I'll live longer, I'll be happier. So that is also a great danger. So that is why, that is also a worry, while the Vaikuntha planets, and Golok being the topmost. But the problem is, not problem, but the challenge is that, the catch, is that in the Vaikuntha planets we cannot go there until we have even the slightest tinge of material desire. And that is where the somehow not accepting any profit, adoration or any prestige, we have to keep working on it. And these are the challenges that may come even to somebody who's trying to follow a spiritual path, let alone someone who is not interested in it at all. But we see, we have examples of how people have transcended, from the most difficult modes. For instance, in the 11th canto, we have the story of the Avanti Brahmin, who actually was, everybody had abandoned him. Though he had, at one time he had money, but because of his nature and his miserliness, he was abandoned by everyone, his family, and it came to a stage where he had nothing. He was robbed of everything, his family were, every single person left him. He was practically completely alone and with nothing. But in that stage, the realization came that actually I don't want anything, I only want you, Krishna. So even from the most, the depths of most difficult situation, the Avanti Brahman came to the realization that all the problems are in the mind. How I perceive, how we perceive things is how we consider that he is my friend, he is my enemy, that this is my happiness, this is my unhappiness. He is my friend, he is not my friend. So the perception and the consciousness has to change. The other example is King Pururava. In the Bhagavatam, Srimad Bhagavatam, 9th canto, there is a wonderful story about King Pururava, who was actually not only a great king, but he came from a dynasty of other great kings who were actually very close to God. But because of his infatuation to Urvashi, who was a very beautiful damsel in the heavenly planets, who was with Indra at that time. So he went to the extreme levels of trying to win her over. He did everything that he could. Anyone, beyond anything anyone can imagine, dedicating his whole thinking how to acquire her, how to get her. And he was a king, therefore he had all the resources. And finally he actually managed to get her. And while he was with her, and then just by some accidental, and he did everything to please her. He did more than one would expect. He dedicated all his resources and life to keep her happy. But by some accidentally he disturbed her. Because it seemed she had told him that she was very fond of her lambs, which she had brought with her. And she didn't, she had said that this is one condition, you have to protect them at all times. And also that he should never appear without clothes to her. So Indra was trying to wean Urvashi away from him, and therefore he conspired to get those lambs, take away the lambs from him. So from her. And so when that happened, and then when she started, Urvashi was, you know, shouting at him that, what have you been doing? Where are my lambs? So he actually, you know, did as he was wanting to. He did all he could. He went after them, and somehow he got the lambs back. But then he brought them to her, and then he was actually without clothes because he was resting, and he just ran off. So then she left him. So at that stage, something like the Avanti Brahman stage, that he had everything, and then the next moment he had nothing, because though he still had the wealth and everything, but for him the most important possession was this beautiful lady. And even though he had everything but her, for his mind was focused only on that one object which he didn't have. This is also a lesson for us, because this is typical, that sometimes we may be desiring for things, and we may be in anguish because we have various problems, and then we find that actually things turn out to be much better. Suddenly the problems are solved. It happens many times. But still, the one problem remains, and then that problem consumes all our thinking. And this is actually the state of situation elsewhere. So when we look at somebody and say that this person must be so happy, he's got everything, but we cannot understand the state of mind. So somebody who may have acquired unbelievable riches, but if we see someone more rich, then that becomes a consuming thought for him, that how he can go more. So similarly here, in the case of Pururava, that became his heart was burning for that. So he did everything, could, he went all over the world looking for her, and that became his focus. Finally he found her, and she actually preached to him very nicely that, you know, this is you are a fool. I mean, why do you have to abandon everything, come for me? And she actually gives him very wise counsel that, you know, ultimately this is a material body and so on. But he heard all this, but still King Pururava's desire was that, no, I want you back. And he did many major yajnas and talked to Vishnu, and finally he got her back. And it is said that then they stayed together for some time, and he tried to enjoy life as it is. But eventually he was so frustrated that even though he had what he wanted, one would say that is the, like we see in the movies, the happy ending. You know, he desired everything, he got it, and that's it. But now comes the catch. Actually, there's a whole chapter in which he says, after many, a long period that he stayed with her, and he was so frustrated, even though he had everything he could. And then he talks about the futility of the material body, and how the frustration and develops when you go after sense objects. So it came out of deep realization. So we can understand that people who have great thinking, great wisdom, and have made mistakes and have learned from their own mistakes, we can see that how they understand life and the realities. But today the difficulty for us is that the entire world is actually dedicating their whole life in pursuing just what we are told to avoid. Because every single-minded pursuit is trying to see how we can eradicate misery and death. Simply put, it is that how do we eradicate misery and death, which a sensible person, even somebody who can listen with an open mind, with an objective approach, would not take long to understand that it is impossible. You don't need deep spiritual understanding. This makes logical sense that there are so many things. Most things are out of our control. Most important being that we cannot stop ourselves from growing old, getting disease, and we are going to die. These are basic, and nobody wants to do that. This doesn't need rocket science to understand. But nevertheless, the whole world is completely moved towards that. And not only that, the powers that be, the levers of the institutions, you know, everything is designed, the science, the technology, everything is to the entertainment, everything is designed to see how they can counter this, that how they can find ways to cover misery. So basically, the attitude of people in the world would be to not to accept reality. And a spiritualist or a devotee, a sincere devotee, would at least be able to, willing to discuss this openly. Sometimes people say that, why you talk about death all the time? Why you talk about these things? I mean, I have this experience that when you talk to people, sometimes, you know, just in casual conversation, when it comes up that, you know, yeah, we ultimately, so, you know, we'll have to die after this. And, you know, it creates such a shock that even the word death, you know, it's like, how can you speak like this? And suddenly they react as if it never existed. But to have a normal conversation, to accept that these are the realities, is very difficult for people to accept. So how can you expect them to open their minds and to really try to see what are the real problems, and is there a solution, and what are the solutions? If Krishna is the controller, and if he's, and still there is misery and death to the human being, so there must be something wrong, because that is this is not the end of life as it should be, because if Krishna is considered is all merciful. But this kind of understanding cannot come because of the overriding deep desire to find a solution to in their own way, and using all the resources to see how they can find happiness in their own way. I mean, people can, the best of the scientists, best in the sense, the academically inclined scientists of the world, they have spent, you know, $10 billion to create some kind of a machine which they claim will, you know, chemically produce life. Now, there is no proof of it, but they have spent probably 2 decades and spent $10 billion to just create one equipment. Oh, it is quite strange, but it is a fact that this is the way. So therefore, why for us to understand that this is what we, what a sincere devotee would be up against, and if we anticipate that, then rather than sitting in judgment, we can just consider how fortunate we are. It's not that we have no understanding how we came into this association. We didn't have a deep desire, so we would take things around us more seriously, appreciate that how Krishna has arranged situations such a way that we have wisdom around us, we have people, great examples around us, people who are sincerely striving, and also who have spent, some of them, you know, have really, we can see the transformations that take place around us. So actually, it's a question of, as Prabhupada put in a very nice analogy, the crows and the swans. Because he said that the swans will always go to the lakes, very beautiful lakes. The swan will go towards the beautiful lotus flowers there, will actually take the nectar from the stem. But the crow, they will never go there. They will go where the garbage is there, where the refuse is there. That is the way they, that's where they find the happiness, their juice, their taste. So it is for us to decide where we would like to be. Whether we want to be with the crows or with the swans. And Prabhupada went on to explain that when he used this analogy, he mentioned that the crows, there were the old crows and the new crows, because the old crows are the ones who have only been born into sense gratification. And he meant the people in the West, because when he was preaching there, at that time, there was a vast distinction, because the lifestyle and the whole the world around the Western civilization was, which is even more so now, but where people were, they had no other thought other than sense gratification. They were born into that, and so they were actually generation after generation after generation only in one single track, and that was not giving happiness. So actually, but they didn't have any other, they didn't know what else to do. So it was not as if they were excited about it. They were tired of it, but they had no choice. So they were what Prabhupada called the old crows. They have nothing else to do, and they don't know anything better. But when he talked, that time there was the Indians, that was just beginning how the of the time when the Indians used to go to the West and settle there for making material progress. And Prabhupada referred to the Indians as the new crows. What he meant is that they have gone there chasing after the garbage because they're abandoning the not only the wisdom but also the source of happiness which is around here, but actually going after the what is actually not going to produce any happiness, but in fact going to entangle them even more. But it became it, and then of course after the 90s when India's economic policy changed and the liberalization, so-called liberalization took place, it was only one way of bringing the Western culture here. So then that is what we now refer to, that now the whole country has become, the India, country of India has become a country of crows. So basically, the distinction between a cultured civilization and a lack of culture would be, is really judged by how an environment is created where the good in us, everybody has the good in them, where which wants to surrender, to be truthful, to follow a sattvic path. How that environment can be promoted. So a civilization which can create that kind of culture where people can actually promote their goodness and in the association of other people like that, bring that out, that is actually really cultured civilization. While any civilization which actually promotes animal propensities and which actually brings the worst in us, you know, our tendencies to get angry, stressed, you know, proud, greedy, and as individuals, and then as collectively, as communities, and as nations, if we move towards it, towards all tendencies, then that actually takes us away from it. So actually, culture civilization would outlaw many of the things that are going on today, but that is not something which is going to happen. So therefore, Prabhupada created ISKCON, which is a life, which is actually is a world where we have the opportunity to create a life on our, which is a world within a world, a spiritual world, which is an opportunity for devotees to take shelter of a lifestyle which can, you know, which can bring them out of all the animal propensities and tendencies. So Prabhupada also talks about he right through, you know, in many of his purports in the in Bhagavatam, he constantly talks about that how if we do not have Krishna as the center of our life and Krishna as the goal of our life, then very likely we will be looking at having other role models. So everybody desires to have an idol, somebody who will be worshipped, and a very simple thing to understand that how a misplaced idol around us, where people are constantly going after the, say, the entertainers or the superstars in sports or maybe in business or in politics or even in so-called social philanthropy, they will create a role model where they want to actually live a life of happiness. They want the bliss, they want the happiness that is associated with spiritual life, but they don't want Krishna. So in that, if they see somebody who they think represents that in their minds, who's successful, who's materially successful, who has influence, power, and who's created such a image. And people completely follow that. And then, of course, they're quick to abandon that also eventually. So that's where the frustration becomes even more. So they're lurching from one to the other. And Prabhupada repeatedly said, actually, when he went to the West, it was a stage where we know that the cultural revolution that was taking place was primarily rejecting all the authority because they did not trust anybody. So they found trust in Prabhupada. Many of the thousands of people did. And by that, that's how they came closer to Vaishnavism. And that's really what the challenge, the greatness of Prabhupada was. So I just wanted to, I was recently reading in a book on George Harrison, and I wanted to just bring this part out because this book written by Yogeshwar Prabhu, who's a devotee, also a very good writer in his own occupation, actually brings out, because George Harrison was right up there in the among the most famous personalities of the last century. And through him and through the people associated with the Beatles, the band group which was very famous, you get just a glimpse of what kind of life, not only what kind of life, but actually how miserable they can be in spite of the situation they were in. So, you know, when this so-called, this was in the period of 1962 to 69, that was that 7, 8, 9 year period. You know, the symptoms of that, I mean, was that whenever they had, when they started becoming successful, tens of thousands of fans used to park themselves all night long outside the box offices, hoping to secure tickets. When they had programs, the police would have to move around with dogs on leashes, right? Because the fans, the people who were their so-called fans, I mean, they went so crazy. People couldn't understand what was the reason, but they were so crazy about the Beatles that, you know, they would actually break the barricades, climb on stage, clamber all over them. It was actually a frightening experience for them. When they would land in airports, not only the airport would be choked, but even the, like when they came to London after they returned from US, the entire city was completely at a standstill. You know, and sometimes in the concerts, these hoses were turned on by the police just to keep away the screaming fans. Young girls by the thousands would write to them about their fantasies. So talk about renunciation, but this is how challenging it would be for young 20-year-olds who are not, you know, just fresh out of their youth. When they went on the first trip to the US, it was as if how you track an enemy bomber, you know, a plane which is coming, you know, in war, everybody so minutely observing. They were actually, the radios across the USA were tracking the approach of their flight, saying that, you know, the Beatles have left 30 minutes ago, now they're flying over the Atlantic, now they're landing, now this is 32 degrees, Beatle degrees. Then when the plane landed, they said that the noise from the huge crowd was so loud that it overtook the roar of the jet engines. And it was routine for them to have the police on motorcycles flanked, you know, by sirens blaring that we see in India often, lights spinning, but in the West it is not common. They gave their first TV show, and there were a capacity of 728 in the studio, and 50,000 fans wanted to jam there. And that show, the first show, one-third of the US, 73 million people watched that. Now, when they were told that, they were so frightened, because it's one thing to want, up to a point, you know, we cannot see the distinction, but actually for them, I mean, they initially tasted the success, but later on they were frightened out of the wits. They didn't know what they were getting into. And on George Harrison's 21st birthday, nearly 1 million cards, letters, and gifts arrived. There were 7 truckloads of mail that filled the entry of their home for several weeks. The postal department said that was the most mail delivered to any one address in the history of UK outside the royal family. know, girls would come and kiss the doorknobs, you know, of the parents' homes, and you know, they were constantly barraging outside. They couldn't even move out. When they went to Adelaide, for instance, in 300,000, half the population of the city came out to see them. And so now, see how the mentality was. When George was asked, he said that we felt like we were monkeys in a zoo, completely trapped. And it was not like he was joking. He was basically, the whole world had become claustrophobic. They were either in the confines of the hotels, then they would go onto the cars, they would go on the stages, they'd go on the recording booths, that's it. The circle was only hotels, cars, stage and recording booth. They had no privacy, they were, and this was for 7-8 years, and this was one of the reasons also they broke up. There was so much of stress in their lives. You know, once George Harrison got so upset that he threw a glass of orange juice at his press secretary because he didn't want to meet some people, and celebrities and actors and top politicians would insist on meeting them. And you know, and then they got into a fight. So this was routine, that they were under enormous stress. Now this is behind closed doors. Externally, everyone was looking at how famous they were. Just to visit, it was unthinkable to even step out of their house. But once in a blue moon, when they wanted to visit a friend, he would have to at least change 3 cabs just to keep the press away or the fans away. So it was like every public movement outside their home was had to be like a military maneuver. It had to be planned in advance. Can you imagine living a day-to-day life like that? So if you see the fame, this is the other side of it. And why? Because people were so desperate, you know, to kind of find an escapism for, you know, they were so unhappy that when they found temporarily, you know, then suddenly everything was, they were putting all their faith in them. Even though George was married, it was quite often that young girls would sneak into, and they had security guards, and they'd sneak into their room, and sometimes they were under their beds. I mean, he's with his wife, and they'd suddenly find these girls in the hotel. So this is what he mentioned, this is the hysteria that was most terrifying to them. And his sister gave a very graphic example. She said, Louise, he was very close to her. And she said that once when they were in Chicago, she remembered that they were all in a hotel and they had to go to a program. So the police had to take them out of the window. So they had to actually climb out of the window. Then they got onto the fire exit and going down. So she remembers one instance. She said when he came out and he turned to look at her because she was quite close. So she said, I will never forget that, you know, it was like I saw in his eyes what he said. It was like the eyes of a deer looking into the barrel of a gun. That was the fear and fright that he had. The eyes of a deer looking. No, if you put a gun and you're about to be to shoot a deer, it's so frightened. That was the fear that he had. So basically, George, because of his understanding, this was before he met Prabhupada. But he could understand. But then when he was interviewed, it was after Srila Prabhupada left this world. So he said that this is the exaggerated expectations from worshippers. And the people had assumed that somebody was successful, he had acquired special powers. So it was routine. One of the frustrating things for them was that disabled children, it is not just in India, this is in the West, that disabled children, children who had no arms or legs, children who were blind, children who were deaf, dumb, parents and caregivers would bring them as if these, just to touch them so that they thought that they had healing powers. And a person like George was very sensitive and he knew his own limitations. And he says in the book, and he says that, you know, we were ordinary people. You know, we were not even very good looking. We were learning our singing. We were not that good. But it was just the kind of craze which, you know, which was actually very depressing for them. So we are talking about how people idolize. If they don't have Krishna, they can completely change and put it into repose it into something which, from both sides. Here we saw from the inside view of people who are receiving it and how frustrating it was for them, how terrifying was it. I mean, it actually is frightening for them. But on the other hand, even from the people who repose the faith And perhaps many of us may have done that in the past, you know, in our childhood or in our youth, as we are growing up. And we find that it is so ridiculous that ultimately they are, we're all human beings, ordinary human beings, but to scale them up. So actually this is the way the world has been created, that it is necessary. And then people market it because there is a huge profit out of that for a lot of people. So it's a whole industry, how to promote people. There's one, I just end this particular episode on one last thing, that they, at that time, George Harrison's The Beatles were the first to actually start the occupying the stadiums. See, till that time they would give concerts, but nobody had the thought that people can actually fill up a whole stadium. No, stadiums would have 60,000-70,000 people. And 50 years ago, it was, you know, people, 5,000-10,000 was considered huge. So when they went to, typically this was happening regularly. So how they would come, that they would be flown in a helicopter, they would land in a nearby mountaintop or somewhere, and then they would be put in an armored truck. And then they would be taken, you know. So initially the first time, second time, perhaps, you know, it's like you feel that special, that this is amazing how you, but regularly it was like as if they were prisoners. You know, they were taken in, shepherded in an armored truck. And then when the armored, this was one particular incident which Yogeshwar Prabhu describes in New York, one stadium. And which he said was typical, that when they happened, when they went there, and it was so, as soon as they arrived, the hysteria and the noise was so deafening, so loud, that the 2,000 police who were there, I mean, they were holding their pain, their ears in agony. They couldn't bear the kind of volume, that shrieking and screaming. But the funny part was that when actually the singing began, he described to Yogeshwar Prabhu, he said that none of us could even hear ourselves. So Ringo Starr, who was the drummer, there were four of them, so the drummer was Ringo Starr. He couldn't even hear what he was playing. So he was only looking at the other three's feet to know, to keep tune. So how their legs would move when they were playing the guitar, and how their backsides would move. Then that's how he was playing to get the rhythm, because he couldn't hear the song. And none of the, they were joint vocalists, they couldn't even hear each other. So they were just looking at the lip synchronization to try to pick up the words. So next day, George Harrison was interviewed, and he was asked, so how was it? He said, it was so sad that the worst part was that I have stopped caring about, he publicly said, I have stopped caring about how I'm singing in this concert. And that was the end of the concert. After that, the Beatles stopped giving concert because they saw, so the last 3 years that they were together, it was not only the pressure, but also that there was no joy even in the singing. So coming back to the question about finding substitutes for Krishna, it is an impossibility. So even the to try to find, because all these are in a sense substitutes that people would see. Somewhere they want to repose the faith. There is a strong desire to repose that, but if it's not put in a worthy person, then it ends in great frustration. And then there's bitterness, there is also disillusionment, and eventually people walk away. Only some will then maybe turn to Krishna consciousness. So, Prabhupada also mentioned that India actually, notwithstanding what is happening now, but eventually the soul of India is still a land of culture, because you can see in so many ways, just now the Kumbh Mela is going on, I mean, how many, tens of millions of people, and you never, and this is happening, this has happened several times in the last 40, 50 years, that it's the largest congregation of people in one place. And yet you never find any kind of bickering, fighting. People live, you know, there are apparently 10,000 different faiths that come there. So eventually there is tolerance and there is a harmony in one particular area where people can actually come and stay for almost a month without, in a peaceful existence. So it is, but this is never highlighted because it is considered very strange. But recently, just last week, I read that the Harvard University has actually commissioned, and they're preparing a case study on this. So they've sent a large team to actually, so they are presently right there. They're studying all the, not only the systems, but also interviewing a lot of people to try to understand how this strange phenomena can happen. So it is ultimately because there's a tolerance within Indians, you know, that they can accept this situation. Also, the acceptance of the laws of karma, Indians, generally most Indians, would accept that without even questioning. I mean, they just understand that. Even the poorest people have an understanding that there is fate, and then how they act will decide their future. So there is a certain restraint because of that. And also, Prabhupada mentioned that only in India, I am receiving people, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 people crowds. It was unheard of. Anywhere outside India, if we could get 200-300 people, it was like a huge crowd. So this was a pointer to ultimately that Indians at least had, and they still have. It is decreasing, but there is a certain sense, an acceptance. It's only that there is a coverage of, because of a lack of precise spiritual knowledge, and therefore they can be taken wayward. But Prabhupada also warned that Maya's agents are actually out to see that India is destroyed. And but Krishna is in control. But why? Because if India's culture is finished, the world is finished. Because if you see, the only hope the world has is primarily to India. And if you look at that from that situation, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's advent has been timed to see that in this age, not only the simplest process has been given, of all the various processes of all the avatars in all the various millenniums in the past, is it a coincidence that it has come in the worst of times? No, in the worst of times, Krishna has given the easiest process, and it is simple to understand, not so simple to follow, but again, if it is done in the association, in the loving environment of sincere, like-minded people, then again it becomes very simple. So the understanding is simple, but then if we do not practice it, and the effort and the determination to change our thinking, to bring ourselves only to the same environment that is that we need to, because that means lifestyle changes, that means so many choices we have to make. And those are the ones where we are tested. But once having done that, then we don't have to think. You just follow the process. You know, everything is there. I mean, just so if we are just putting off our faith, our loyalty, our our love in our friendship, everything in an environment which is trusted, which is our mind and intelligence has already told us that this is to accept. Then beyond that, we just have to hang on to the coattails and we will be taken up. But then hanging on means that we don't abandon it at any circumstances. You know, if we suddenly find something unpleasant happening with some devotee, or we find something very, very profitable, or something very attractive in the outside world, something which changes our material fortune, those kind of various temptations may come. At those are the times we need to, if we are able to overcome that, then all other limitations would be taken care of just by following the path that Srila Prabhupada has given. And that is where we say that the greatness of Srila Prabhupada, that he had the vision to create in the parampara of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu a situation where, given us the process also, he has brought down the 64 rounds of chanting to 16 rounds, and just basically avoiding the four pillars of sinful activities, and associating with devotees. These are the only basic requirements that Prabhupada has put. So, and he has given us a way where we can actually combine our external occupational needs with the internal consciousness, which needs to guide the our external life. So we end here. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Are there any questions? Any comments? So ग्रंथराज श्रीमद् भागवतम की जय, श्रील प्रभुपाद की जय।